This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
I think the murder really hit people the hard way. For, you know, majority of people, even those who are leaning towards this is going to be a pretty much peaceful election, this was a wake-up call that whoever did it, timing notwithstanding, because it was 1 week to the election.
That's Abdullahi Halaki, Amnesty International East Africa researcher. We'll have full details coming up.
Also, Yemen is said to be in the grips of one of the biggest cholera outbreaks in decades, and the executive secretary of Rwanda's National Electoral Commission says the absence of election observers from the EU will not impact the credibility of Rwanda's upcoming election.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, Amnesty International warns recent events in Kenya, including the murder of a top Electoral Commission official, are creating a cloud of fear that must be properly addressed ahead of next week's election. Chris Msando was in charge of the electronic voting system at the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. He was murdered 3 days after his family reported him missing to the police. In addition, the human rights organization says numerous threatening statements have been made by high-ranking officials and politicians that infringe on people's right to freedom of expression and information. Abdullahi Halake is Amnesty International's East Africa researcher. He spoke with me about the fears of Kenyans as the election approaches.
I think the murder really hit people the hard way. For, you know, majority of people, even those who are leaning towards this is going to be a pretty much peaceful election, this was a wake-up call that whoever did it, timing notwithstanding, because it was 1 week to the election, on the day when he was supposed to be spearheading, testing the equipment or the ICT infrastructure, that we're being told he's been murdered. So that has really thrown off a lot of people. There's a fair degree of anxiety what the election will be like. For a lot of people, it's generating this dark sense of foreboding. So that is the state of play right now. I'm hoping that, you know, this weekend on Monday, things will be different. People will come out and cast their votes for the candidates of their choice.
Have police released any information regarding a suspect?
They say they have 3 suspects, but, you know, those are just what the papers are reporting right now. The newspapers are saying that they have 3 suspects. They have been able to piece together the last movement of Mr. Msando. At this stage, what we have is what the newspapers are reporting, quoting government officials.
Why are some statements by government officials, why are they a cause for concern right now?
With the government, I think particularly around the Ministry of Information and Communications, Cabinet Secretary's statement that the media should not be announcing the results. Those are concerned because the media can report, but the media cannot declare. The authority rests with the Independent Electoral Boundaries Commission on declaring who is the winner. But that doesn't prevent the media, of course, from the Independent Electoral Commission and also tallying it and saying this guy has this number of votes. That is not anywhere against the law. So when the government says the media should not announce, I think it's an infringement on the rights of, you know, freedom of expression, association, and even freedom to receive and impart any kind of information. So that is a concern for us because the law is very clear. The Elections Act is very clear. The authority that will declare who is a winner or not, the Independent Electoral Boundaries Commission.
What are your biggest concerns right now with the election now less than a week away?
One that concerns us is the peaceful assembly. If for one reason or the other, people feel very strongly about a particular situation, they come out, express that, and the police react disproportionately, that becomes an area of concern for us. Secondly, also potential internet, you know, slow/shutdown. That also becomes a cause of concern because those are moments when, you know, things can go wrong. Because of the kind of atmosphere that we have, where there is a fair degree of polarization in the country, if, for instance, the equipment fail, not because of any nefarious activity by anybody, but just standard equipment failure, people start having doubts, and that also might cast some doubt about the legitimacy of the elections.
Abdullahi Halaki is Amnesty International's East Africa researcher. He spoke with me from Nairobi.
Yemen is said to be in the grips of one of the biggest cholera outbreaks in decades. Save the Children runs 14 cholera treatment centers and more than 90 rehydration units across the country. The organization says it is scaling up its response to the crisis and sending more health experts to the worst-hit areas. The organization also said more than 425,000 suspected cases of cholera have been reported across Yemen, with 1,900 deaths. The Saudi-led campaign against Yemen's Shiite Houthi rebels has damaged infrastructure and caused medicine shortages in the Arab world's poorest country.
In Malawi, support staff of the country's judicial system are holding a sit-in. They want the government to give them housing allowances and arrears accumulated since 2014. The strike comes amid failed negotiations between government and the representatives of the judiciary workers over the matter. Lamek Messina reports from Blantyre.
Since Monday, the striking workers have been spending their working hours outside the court chanting and singing. Among them are court critics, marshals and messengers. The action comes 5 months after judges and magistrates staged a similar sit-in to press government to pay them housing allowances and other arrears. Andy Haliwa is the spokesperson for the striking workers.
The government gave housing allowances to senior officers in the judiciary, especially judicial officers, sidelining members of staff. Now, as one system of government, we felt that it's bad. Why should others get housing allowances whilst others are not having it?
Haliwa says previously they were all receiving the housing allowances, but they were removed sometime in early 2000 after government reviewed their wages. The strike has paralyzed judicial operations.
We feel sorry that the public out there cannot access justice, but it's not our fault. It is our prayer that the minister responsible should respond to our grievances as soon as possible.
Kudo Gondo is the Minister of Finance. He said the strikers will not get what they want.
In 2004, we combined housing allowances with the basic salary, and therefore the salaries that we're receiving now include housing allowance. And so when they're asking for housing allowance, no, they will not have it. They can't have it twice.
Gondwe said the government will soon have closed door negotiations to resolve the matter with the striking workers. But Haliwa, who works as a human resources officer, denied having been given housing allowances in 2014, he said there's been no such communication from the government on the matter. Haliwa said the strikers will not return to work until their demands are met. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The absence of election observers from the European Union will not impact the credibility of Rwanda's upcoming election. That's the word from the Executive Secretary of Rwanda's National Electoral Commission, Charles Munyanza. He was responding to reports that the European Union would send an observer mission to monitor Kenya's polls, but not Rwanda's.
Of those, we've got over 400 international observers from Europe, from Africa and everywhere. Now, specifically talking about one organization that said originally that they wouldn't be sending these observers, especially the European Union, I think it was a misrepresentation. What they have not done is sending people from Europe, observers from Europe, from their countries. But as I talk now, we have accredited observers from each and every embassy, every European embassy accredited to Rwanda. Everybody has sent observers.
Munyanza says the credibility of elections are influenced by several factors, including turnout and how the election is managed. Rwanda will hold its presidential election on Friday, August 4th. Incumbent President Paul Kagame is predicted by most analysts to win. Munyanza says more than 1,700 observers, most of whom will be from Africa, will monitor Friday's polls.
The Ugandan government has introduced in Parliament an amendment of the Constitution that some have interpreted as a way to grab public land. However, the government insists that the amendment is meant to make it easier to implement government projects. Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
The amendment to Article 26 of the Constitution is meant to facilitate faster acquisition of land by government for infrastructure and investment projects. It's also meant to reduce delays due to disputes arising out of the compulsory land acquisition process. Such projects include public infrastructure such as roads, electrification, rail lines, and even healthcare and schools. The government has cited 18 projects it says have been delayed by court disputes. These include the acquisition of land in Bulisa District in southwestern Uganda for international oil companies in Uganda such as Talo and China National Offshore Oil Corporation for petroleum activities and midstream operations. Mwesigwa Rukutana is the Deputy Attorney General of Uganda.
The program of delayed government projects has caused significant financial loss to the government, amounting to millions of dollars in penalties paid to contractors for redundant machinery at the project sites and the court's attempt to resolve the disputes, most of which relate to quantum of compensation.
Currently, Article 26, Section 2 of the Constitution states that no one can be compulsorily deprived of property without prompt payment of fair and adequate compensation prior to the taking of the property. In 2014, Uganda's Supreme Court ruled in favor of the public in a petition filed by lawyers Irumba Asmani and Peter Magela versus the Uganda National Roads Authority. The government had commissioned a project to upgrade the Hoima Kaisotonya Road leading to Uganda's oil fields in the Albertine Graben. Lawyer Magela explains why they took the government to court.
People were being paid less than $300. And now the present proposal is saying, if you don't agree with us giving you that money, we are going to deposit it somewhere. When you want it, you'll find it there. So they are even removing your ability to access justice.
But Betty Amongi, the Minister of Lands, Housing and Urban Development, says these fears are unfounded.
Under the Land Acquisition Act, we give 14 days notice. The 14 days notice is to tell the landowner that on this day, the chief government valuer is going to be in this place. You are requested as a landowner to come with a pre-filled form stating the acreage of your land, the value of your land, and evidence to show the value you want. So it's not that the chief government valuer walks in with a figure.
The amendment is currently being studied by the Parliamentary Committee of Legal Affairs, which will guide the House on the way forward. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
As in many cities in Africa, housing in Zimbabwe's capital Harare and other urban center is expensive and difficult to find. Despite high demand, consumers have shown little interest in a low-income housing scheme by a local bank. Reporter Kuzai Zanowashe looks at the housing situation in Harare.
A case of rural to urban migration combined with other factors has resulted in an increasing demand for accommodation in Harare. The most direct way of buying land is through city council, which identifies available land for sale to individuals and companies to develop. Simbara Shemoyo, the chairperson of Combined Harare Residents Association, says, however, that is not as easy as it sounds.
From what we are noting, based on our observations and some SNAP surveys, the general picture is that the local authority, which is the city of Harare, is failing dismally to provide housing to all those who want housing. I can give you some statistics here that in its housing waiting list, we've got more than 1.5 million people who are waiting to be given stands.
Ironically, the public reaction has been lukewarm to 3,200 houses built by a local bank, KEBS. Tandeka Sibanda, a resident in Harare, says KEBS failed to adequately package their housing scheme.
My personal view is that KEBS missed it. It would have been ideal in a normal economic environment. First of all, the environment that we are in at the moment, economically, is now an informalized economy. But KEBS is failing to adjust towards the informalized economy. People have money. There are people that have money, but they are in the informal sector, and they can't access those houses. KEBS insist on having a payslip. In this time and age in Zimbabwe, how many people do have a payslips? Very few.
KEBS requested questions in writing and had not responded at the time of broadcasting this report. Such formal housing schemes have not inspired the consumers, many of whom lack job security. While others say the houses are too expensive, some banks are slowly adjusting. Instead of asking for proof of payment, they are requesting proof of income. City Council spokesperson Michael Chideme says he and others have been thinking of ways of making the homes more affordable.
Why don't we allow city employees to take over the houses, and then the monies are deducted from their salaries? And then the other option was, why can't we open it to everybody? Because housing is for everybody. So those were just suggestions from council. And council is entitled to make those suggestions, because when it gave out land for housing, the expectation was there would be an uptake of those houses and they would be occupied, and council would reduce the housing waiting list. So that's where the concern of council comes in.
Moyo says due to the expense of the homes, the rich are buying the houses and leasing them out to the low-income earners. Because of the challenges that come with getting housing, many citizens looking to get homes they call their own have fallen victims of the land barons who have been parceling out land. The Harare City Council has been demolishing homes built on unsanctioned land, leaving many without shelter. Moyo says the ruling ZANU-PF has failed to stop the problem because, he says, they are linked to the land barons. As a solution for many Harare citizens, they have been looking to get land on the outskirts of the capital, but there have been cases of land barons taking advantage of the unsuspecting citizens. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 22 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Amnesty International warns recent events in Kenya, including the murder of a top Electoral Commission official, are creating a cloud of fear in the country. And Yemen is said to be in the grips of one of the biggest cholera outbreaks in decades. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Over the past 50 years, more than $1 trillion in foreign aid have gone to Africa. However, despite this huge amount of aid, sub-Saharan Africa remains the world's poorest region. Sylvanus Ayeni is the author of the book Rescue Thyself, Change in Sub-Saharan Africa. He says change must come from within. He argues that corruption, bad governance, and selfishness have to be reformed in the region. The author spoke to VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi and explained why.
History tells us that nations always develop from within. Sometimes a nation or nations will need help from outside. However, sustainable long-term development emanates from within nations. The ancient African civilizations of the savannah, the Ghana Empire of the 7th to 13th century, the Mali Empire 13th to 17th century, were all built on pastoral agricultural economy, urban trade, and trade with North Africans. And we should remember at that time, there was no World Bank, no International Monetary Fund, no United Nations and its agencies, no United States is for international development. So how did these sub-Saharan Africans do it? They did it with visionary, bold leadership from within, as far as the historical records show.
In your book, you argued that in the past 50 to 60 years, more than $1 trillion in foreign aid have gone to Africa. If that's so, what are the needed changes to reverse such poverty? Because apparently you believe that no amount of foreign aid can reverse the poverty in this area.
Absolutely. Let me state that the resuscitation of these sub-Saharan African nations is a daunting task, and nobody should pretend to have the perfect answers to the huge problems facing these nations. There is this exponential increase in foreign aid and thousands of philanthropic organizations, religious organizations, celebrities. You have this exponential increase in aid over 5 to 6 decades concomitant with an exponential increase in the deepening poverty. So that should tell all of us something. What we need is a new type of leadership in this nation, resulting in the replacement of massive corruption with integrity, replacement of selfishness and greed with selflessness, and replacement of widespread injustice with justice. And they should provide the opportunities and the liberty and freedom for their citizens.
So till the needed political reforms would take place, what should the donor demand from sub-Saharan nations who need help in order to ensure sustained reverse of poverty?
One, the donors should demand more accountability and transparency from the government. Two, the foreign aid must not be open-ended. There must be stop gaps. And if the objectives are not being met, the donors should not hesitate to quit. All the projects by any donor must have an educational component. The old proverb, you teach a man to fish, you just don't continue to give him fish to eat. You teach him how to fish. And then finally, if possible, the donors should avoid the corrupt levels of government, national, state, etc., and go straight to the suffering masses in the villages, where the aid is needed most.
The international community is concerned about Boko Haram terrorist activities in Nigeria and the plight of refugees emanating from the civil war in southern Sudan. How could your argument apply to these two particular problems?
These two situations are without a doubt two of the most devastating colossal calamities that plague sub-Saharan Africa. The problem with this, one can simply put it as total abysmal failure of leadership. Let's take the situation in Nigeria. With billions of pound sterling and US dollars stolen from the coffers of the Nigerian government over several decades, not much is left to train and have a first-class police force, military, army, air force, etc. Not much is left.
That was author Sylvanus Alyeni, president of Pan-Africa Children Advocacy Watch. He was speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers. All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.